Alright, play the intro.
Let's get that intro. Do you want the spooky one, or do you
want... Nope.
You get to pick.
No, I want the normal one. Get some real regular? Use okay. out of it, you know?
I'm really excited for my Thanksgiving rendition. It will be really good.
Can you do birthday ones for all of our birthdays?
I'll oh do- my god, you better.
That'd be so cute.
It would be so cute.
That's so funny.
Hello, and welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the podcast where we talk about anything and everything. I'm Ella, and today we will be covering a big science topic, we'll be answering a question, and we'll be diving into a little miscellaneous topic. I'm covering the big topic today, and we will be talking about mind-controlling parasites.
Oh,
I'm so excited. Oh my god, I love this so much.
Now, Ella, did you come up with this idea, or did a little parasite tell you to spread the good word of this topic?
Well, very good. Very good.
I'm so excited. my name's Caroline, and I'm going to be doing the question this week, which is, are elephants right-handed or left-handed?
No.
Oh, I love it. That's so cute.
No.
Super I gotta cute. Know.
Oh. My name's Tom, and today's miscellaneous topic is one of my favorite pieces and genres of art, which is the Naruto Bohemian Rhapsody AMVs. And I promise that isn't a joke.
What does that even mean?
We'll break it down.
That is genuinely no idea what you just said.
No, no, I'm so excited nonetheless.
I feel like normally we're on a level pop culture wise, but today you've really just gone right over my head.
Am I finally being out nerded again? Is this going to be a back and forth thing every week
this
now?
This is revenge for yeah. it. So, Ella and Carolyn, you both know what it means when we play this music, right?
No.
No. Not even a little bit, Tom. What's happening?
It's time for today's ad topic, and today's ad topic is the Awesome Socks Club. So what's y'all's familiarity with the Awesome Socks Club?
Excuse me, what? I'm sorry, what?
So for those who don't know, the Awesome Socks Club is a monthly sock subscription, and the person who runs it, Hank Red or Green, I think Hank Green gave us an affiliate link, which means...
I think it's Orange.
It might be Hank Orange. I mean, yes, sorry, I'm so sorry. I never read any of those. I don't watch any of those. So if you go to letslearneverythingpod.com/socks between November 5th and 14th, every subscription you get supports the podcast.
Oh my god.
But it doesn't just do that. All proceeds goes towards Partners in Health as they work to decrease maternal and child mortality in Sierra Leone, where it is the highest in the world. Hank and John and the folks at DFTBA and the rest of the Nerdfighter community have been working with Partners in Health on this for over 2 years at this point, which is, they're working in more than just socks. You know, this is not just a one-off project.
They're doing such great work.
Partners in Health are working with the communities there to strengthen every facet of the healthcare system. But it isn't just that. You also get socks. Socks designed by independent artists. They range from cute to cool to funny. I got these socks each month last year, and it has been such a wonderful way to mark time. And they're good socks. I'm a big sock person. I'm very picky about my socks. And these aren't those cheap print-on pattern socks. These are real-ass socks that I've been wearing for over a year at this point. Still comfortable. And I get comments about them on my TikToks all the time.
These aren't those fake socks that people normally send you.
No.
You just lie one side across your feet. It doesn't even cover both sides of your feet. These socks they cover the whole foot.
These aren't those fake socks that are just painted onto people's feet. No. These are real socks. You'll get your socks delivered starting January next year. Shipping is free. You can cancel anytime if you change your mind, which is great. But you can only sign up between November 5th and November 14th. Less than 2 weeks. And then never again. So go to letsleareverythingpod.com/socks to support the podcast, support Partners in Health, and support your feet.
Woo!
Oh my god.
Amazing!
Oh,
this is so cool! Love your feet. Go get these socks.
Socks!
Socks!
Smash that sock button!
Let's just dive straight into this big old thing.
Let's do it.
We are looking at mind-controlling parasites. Really, I mean behavior-controlling parasites.
So excited.
That's a really interesting distinction. That's a good point.
It's not necessarily... I don't know, I think mind-controlling implies that like there's thinking involved, but there isn't in a lot of these cases.
It's very anthropomorphic, mm-hmm. very human-centric, mm-hmm. yeah, way to think about it, yeah.
Exactly. And very few of these I'm talking about can infect humans.
Are we going to talk about cordyceps today?
Of course we're going to talk about cordyceps!
Yes! I'm so excited!
Of
okay,
course
wonderful.
We are.
Let's go.
Because it is, I think, probably one of the best-known mind-controlling parasites. I did a little video on it on TikTok. One of them I did. And anyone who's interested in this kind of thing is probably familiar with this.
I think I've done like 3 or 4 videos on them, yeah.
Yeah, funguses that make zombies, basically. I'm going to have to say a lot of Latin fungus names. And so you're really just going to have to forgive me for any shit that comes out of my mouth. The first one I'm going to talk about is, I would say, the more commonly known one. It's called, bear with me, Ophiocordyceps unilateralis. Fuck! Oh, I was so close! Okay, let's try that
Ella
again.
Just like practicing in the mirror last night.
I had to say encephalopathy in a TikTok the other day, and it took me so long to say it in one go.
Encephalopathy.
Fuck me. I did all this after my degree and I cannot say any of it. Okay. I'm going to talk about Ophiocordyceps unilateralis. Killed it.
Nice!
There we go.
Well done.
First take. Wow.
Thanks. Yeah. Totally. So, the spores of this fungus infect ants in rainforests of Brazil, Thailand, and Africa. And develop inside of its body. And when they're ready to spread, it causes the ant to climb up to about a height of 25 centimetres specifically. I don't know why. Yes I do, because I have it written down. I started writing this topic when we were still doing our practice runs, so I actually can't remember some of it. So this is like learning again for me. It's so exciting.
Wonderful.
So this is because it's a more humid microclimate that's favourable to the fungus's growth.
Oh, wow. I didn't realise such a short distance would make such a huge difference to them.
Yeah.
I know. The fact that it can be that precise in its distance, I don't understand at all. I don't think anyone does.
That's just that. That's insane.
That's wild. Yeah, how... So, and I apologise, conceptually what a microclimate is, can I ask?
It's basically just what you think it is, which is within a small area, a tree, different parts will have different levels of humidity, temperature.
Wild.
Yeah, it's probably more important for plants than it is for people.
Right, and I'm sure to scale for them it's a lot.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I can tell, for example, if I go upstairs, it's hotter. So.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm sure a plant can tell the 25-centimeter difference, or a fungus in this case. So the ant, once it's got up there, it will clamp onto the tree or plant with its mandibles and then just wait to die. And then the fungus will erupt from its body and spread spores. I think it's very cool. It's very metal, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I definitely recommend anyone listening to go and look at some pictures if you haven't seen it before, because it's super cool. And I've talked about this before, and a lot of people have, but I don't think necessarily people always go into how does it cause the ant to do this.
Mm.
Especially since I think ants have like they're incredibly strong navigators, and they have like an exceptional sense of where they need to be. So to disrupt this kind of behaviour, you know, must be quite a specific mechanism.
Yeah.
So I guess I thought that the fungus, when I was reading through, I was kind of guessing, I thought the fungus might mess with this kind of system in their brain. But that's just not true.
Oh.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so I read a National Geographic article, and researchers from Penn State University, they did fluorescence microscopy to watch the fungal colonization inside of the ants, and they found no trace of fungal cells in the brain.
Wow, really?
It's wild, isn't it? Yeah.
Really?
Super, super weird. They charted the movement of the fungi as it formed like a sort of tubular scaffolding within and around the ants' muscle bundles, basically. So it suggests that the fungus is controlling the host's muscles directly. So it's just making them walk.
Wow.
Which I think is, like, even
it's
wilder.
It's so much worse, wow. I think.
It's so much worse.
That really goes to show how much our human biases are towards this. That it's, like, if it's making it do something, it must be, like coercing its thoughts.
In its brain, yeah.
But in reality...
Does it not stress you out thinking that the ant might be, like, conscious of its body being moved?
Well, so I know a little bit about this. I think this applies to ants. I'm pretty sure if, like, the ant colony notices an ant with this, they will pick up that ant and remove it from the area so that it doesn't infect other ants. And the thought the thought of that ant being somewhat conscious whilst that's happening to them is horrifying.
Oh, no.
So this is, like, literally a scene in the zombie movie where, like, someone is bit and they have to, like...
remove them.
This is definitely very anthropomorphizing of us, because I'm sure that ant probably isn't feeling, like, sad about it.
Ants probably don't have emotions in a human way.
It's probably like, yeah, I need to go.
Yeah, yeah. For the good of the colony.
For the good of the group, right? But from my perspective, that's dark.
Yeah, yeah. I will say that does make sense, because when you think about how simple, like, these spores are that infect these ants, they don't have, like, you know, like, a central brain to them to dictate, you know, it's not like a computer hacking another computer. It's like there are these, like, microorganisms almost trying to, like, come up with a way. And so it has to be a mechanism that's, like, robust and that can be accomplished through almost like nanoparticles, right? Or, like, when we think of that in sci-fi, you know, like they have to be able to coordinate a system that's robust rather than it being like, I'm a fungus and I choose to make you do this. It has to be something that works. So it totally makes sense that it's something that, like, is, yeah. But yes, please go on. I'm fascinated to hear more.
I do want to say ants do have brains.
Yes.
They do have brains. Just because at the start it sounded like you said that they didn't, but they do. They're very small and very, like, the complexity is incredibly simple. But they do have them. So, I mean, our guts are probably more complex neuronally than an ant's brain.
But we do have smart guts. We got smart
guts.
That's
not to diminish ants. I think they're really cool.
Yeah.
Not to diminish ants. Like, I'm trying to be woke for ants.
All right, we have a big, we're like half 50% Spotify, 50% ants is our podcast demographic. Like, please, tread
the
carefully.
Ants in the comment section are gonna go off. Oh my god.
I know.
Also, I should say we've finally been sponsored this week by Picnic Crumbs. Picnic Crumbs. Pick one up near you.
Okay, back to the fungus. So that's the end of that little bit, but I will say that researchers have identified over 200 species of Ophiocordyceps that can infect hosts from 10 insect orders and spiders. Not all of them cause behavioral manipulation. One more that does, I mean, there are a few more that does, but one example is Ophiocordyceps sinensis. I feel like I probably spelt that wrong, because I feel like it must be sinensis, but it says sinensis, so let's find out. Someone in the comments. No, you can't on a podcast. Someone send us an email. Let me know.
Shout really loud and we might hear you.
Anyway, so this one, it colonizes ghost moth caterpillars and then erupts from their heads specifically. The pictures of this are also very, very gnarly. Interestingly, the husk left of these infected caterpillars is actually used in traditional Chinese medicines as an immune booster and aphrodisiac.
Interesting. Huh.
Yeah. No, a similar fungus. Oh, fuck. I'm not going to be able to say this one. Right, I'm going to try it once slowly, and then I'm going to try it once quickly.
We believe in you.
You
can say it slowly, and we can speed it up.
Thank you. Entomophthora musca. No, you know what? I don't know if that...
Entomophthora musca?
Entomophthora musca. I think that sounds right.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Entomophthora musca, meaning insect destroyer of the fly. In Greek.
Oh my god.
What? Oh my god.
That's so
gnarly.
Metal.
Holy shit.
And it works in a very similar way to Ophiocordyceps. It causes the infected flies to climb to a certain height, to glue themselves by the mouth to a plant, and then have written assume an abdomen up death pose for optimum spore dispersal.
That's my favorite yoga pose. Abdomen up death pose.
I love this. I think that, yeah, Cordyceps seems to be specifically get the insect to go somewhere, die, and then they'll spread the spores, right? A lot of, pretty much all funguses that infect hosts work this way, but there is one that I find particularly cool, and it's called Massospora cicadini... Oh, so close. So close that time. It's called Massospora cicadina.
And I'm pretty sure that translates to very difficult to pronounce.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, so bad with these. So, of course, as the name implies, it infects cicadas. Mm. I mean, they spend... So, for those who don't know, cicadas spend 13 to 17 years under... We don't have them in the UK, which is why I'm explaining them.
Oh, really?
We don't get them, yeah.
No. When people started talking about them, the first time I'd heard about them, I was, like, terrified. That the idea that they erupt from the ground at the same time, there's like a season. We do have something similar, it's flying ant season. There's like a year when all of the flying ants in the country come out. It's very gross.
This is a big, I'm taking a note, I need to do a topic on this, because they are very near and distant.
Yes!
They're like, it's like the sound of summer is cicadas. I mean that unironically. For me,
no,
buzzing...
So I actually agree with you, but only because I watch so much anime. And it's such a nice background noise in anime. So I was aware what cicadas were, but I wasn't aware how disturbing they were as creatures. Like this idea of being a
Can I ask? Does them being underground? I can't tell if that would help or hinder these funguses. Because on the one hand, I feel like so far the go to has been climb up.
Well, the fungus gets them while they're.
Okay.
Underground. So, yeah, it's the best place for them to get to be infected, right?
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, wow.
For those who don't know, cicadas spend 13 to 17 years underground feeding on roots before erupting from the earth in what I assume is a very biblical way. As I say, I don't know. We don't have them here. But it would be a shame if you spent all that time getting ready to emerge only to be infected by a horrible mind-controlling parasite.
Oh,
so, Massospora infects cicadas and causes the... Oh, okay, so, yeah, infects them underground, and it causes... I literally just read my notes and was like, oh, yeah, this is gnarly.
Can you believe that?
I'm so excited by the own information that I researched.
No, this is great.
It causes the hard outer layer of the cicada's abdomen to like flake away, so their butts literally fall off, so they're like just like exposed at the end of their bodies.
This mind controlling virus makes bugs lose their butts, is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, and that should be the title of the episode.
I feel like that's like a Captain Underpants story of a mind controlling thing that makes kids lose their butts.
So it reveals, when their butts fall off, it reveals something quite horribly called a fungal plug.
Oh.
And it's basically replaced many of the organs of the cicada.
Oh.
The cicada just doesn't even know. It just carries on as if nothing has changed. And then they fly around, raining spores down on all the other insects and the land. It's really, it's really messed up. And so Matt Kaysen, a fungus researcher from West Virginia University, calls them salt shakers of death.
They're not wrong. I wish they were wrong. I really do wish they were wrong. But that is so on the nose.
You should, yeah, look at some images of these as well, because they're pretty interesting.
I've never heard of these.
I just want to give cicadas a hug right now. Oh my god.
This, I'm just also, and I'm sure I'll continue to be amazed if we go on, but like, this coevolution is fascinating. It's amazing that like, two completely different, because funguses are a completely different, are they a different kingdom from insects even? They're not even...
Yeah.
Fungi are a separate kingdom from plants and animals to be able to, like... And to... Oh, my God. And it's, like, it's like, genius and, like, diabolical almost.
It is. It feels evil.
But it just arises by nature of just and in a bit, well, I mean, as you were explaining it, in some ways it makes perfect sense, right? You have these little guys digging underground, and then you have these fungi that are just like, hey, I'm just gonna like stick onto you, fuck, you know, like chill out inside of your body, and then peace out of your butt. Peace and out of your butt. Oh my god.
Can recommend, if anybody, please Google photos of this, because it is horrible and really cool.
Yeah, it really is. And I'm just, the thing is, it gets even better. The idea, like, Tom, the idea of you saying, you know, the fact that this is developed this way.
Yeah.
Just wait to see how they do this is, I think, like, mind-blowingly cool.
I'm so curious. I'm so fascinated.
So, this guy, Matt Kaysen from West Virginia University, his team collected and tested cicadas. And they found that the fungal plug of the cicadas were full of the hallucinogen found in magic mushrooms, psilocybin.
Ooh. Whoa!
This, and what's more amazing is this is despite the fact that mushrooms have evolved separately from this fungus, Mesospora, for 900 million years. They developed psilocybin separately.
Wow!
Holy shit! That is so cool!
They also produce an amphetamine called cathinone. And basically what happens is they pump cicadas full of these drugs, and that's probably what controls them. Because their organs, their basically insides are just full of the fungus, they shouldn't really be able to function properly.
Right.
But they just carry on moving as if half of their body isn't missing. And that's probably because of the effects of, like, the drugs.
Wow.
The male cicadas also become hypersexual and even mimic female cicadas' wing flicks to attract males. And that's to help the fungus spread.
Oh no!
So it reminds me of, it's sort of like surgical practices in a way, right? You literally anesthetize an area, and are able to. Oh my god!
Yeah. That's
hey, remember at the beginning when you said that these don't affect humans? I'm now very thankful for that that disclaimer at the top, so I could listen, I could enjoy this.
I do
this
have
more.
A fact in a way that
don't,
it
Ella,
does.
Ella?
I have a way that it does affect humans. Don't worry, it can't infect us in the way it affects cicadas. But my favorite thing about this fungus is that Mark Kaysen, the researcher, said that it is possible to get high by eating these cicadas.
Why are people like this?
He's like, yeah, I just found it out.
It was totally by accident.
I don't know how I found it. It just slipped into my mouth, and oh no.
I fell over,
dang.
And all of a sudden I was just like high on cicada.
I don't know how many
I just happened
to
bring a bag of them with me when I went out to the mountains on a camping trip, and they happened to fall into my mouth. Oh, crazy, a while. wow,
that's the end of my fungus section. I'll allow you to sit on that for a minute.
Well, hold on. So wait, we're gonna go beyond fungi.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Humans.
Yes.
Oh
mammals,
my god.
Humans don't. I could find there isn't like a mind controlling fungus that affects humans. So
thankfully.
And I assume at the end we're gonna cover mind controlling humans like Criss Angel.
Oh my
and the
god.
Like, who...
Appalling.
Hypnotize people.
I assume we're going to talk about... Are we going to talk about Toxoplasma gondii at some point?
We are going to talk about Toxoplasma gondii.
Hi, listeners. I today will be playing the role as the audience surrogate who does not understand these
yeah,
words
we've got
flying over my head.
Toxoplasma gondii, which I just say Toxoplasma gondii, not Toxoplasma gondii I, but I might be wrong.
It doesn't matter which way you say it, I don't think.
It really doesn't.
Right, me too. Yeah, I say that as well.
Actually,
that's what I typically, when I'm talking about this, I usually say that also.
It's a pretty popular one amongst people who like mind-controlling parasites.
It's a good one.
Community.
I will get to that. I'm gonna finish this insect section first.
Ooh, okay, cool. Very quickly.
There aren't that many behavior-controlling parasites I could find that aren't funguses in insects. There are a few. But one that I found really interesting because it's so disgusting, it's called Spinocordotis tellini. I found this, first of all, I want to say that I found this on a blog spot called Parasite of the Day.
Hey, wonderful.
Oh my God.
Which is amazing. And this is a blog post from I caught my information from elsewhere as well, but this is how I found it initially. I found this in a blog post from 2010, and they're still posting monthly.
No.
Yeah.
No, I don't need to be aware of that many parasites.
Fortunately, a lot of the parasites are not particularly scary ones. There are a lot of parasites in the world, and a lot of them just kind of exist.
You know what? Good point. I gotta check my bias.
But this one does not just exist.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no.
But Spinocordotis tellini, it's a nematomorph, which is a nematomorph. So they're also known as horsehair worms. The name, very apt. Very, very long, thin, skinny worms. Really disgusting looking. The adults of these types of worms live freely in water. But their larvae develop in grasshoppers and crickets. So when the larvae is... The larvae are laid into the grasshoppers and crickets. And when they're ready to become aquatic, which is when they've grown 3 to 4 times larger than their host, they cause the grasshoppers or cricket to jump into water and drown themselves so that the worm can spin away, swim away.
I would just like to add, I've just Googled a photo of this. Once again, horrifying. What the fuck? Yeah. Ew, don't like it. Nasty, bad, gross.
It is nasty, bad, gross. And unfortunately, that's really all I have on it. There's not a lot of information on how they get the host to do this. It's not a particularly buzzing area of research, apparently. The last paper I could find, it was from like 2005. All we know is that the parasite produces proteins that affect the central nervous system, and that's about the extent of the information. So that's pretty gnarly.
That is so gnarly.
so that sucks.
Yeah.
So I would hate that.
I wouldn't want to be a grasshopper right now. Just saying.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
Wowza.
There you go. So like I said, many of these behavioral controlling parasites, most of them actually work through insects. And I wonder if this is because of the relatively simplistic nature of an insect's nervous system, like we've talked about. You know, it makes them easier to control, for lack of a better word. But there are plenty of parasites that change the behaviour of other animals, mammals specifically. I'm actually going to talk about one that everyone knows about because I found out a bunch more information about it that I didn't know before, and that's rabies.
Yeah!
Right!
Rabies is, like, I didn't realise... Everyone knows about rabies in some way, but I think not a lot of people have... actually any in-depth information on it.
No, it's such a like pop, like I feel like the number of cartoons that like mention rabies is like totally disproportionate to what it actually is, but it's one of those things that like why is it such in the popular culture as a concept?
I mean, rabies has been eradicated in the UK. There's only a few countries in the world that have like the, you know, the acclaimed title of eradicated rabies, and I think that's probably because we have very good animal control. We don't have many stray animals. And we still have bats in the country that have rabies, but apparently that doesn't count because I don't think there's any way to stop that from happening. So rabies is caused by a genus of RNA viruses called lysoviruses. And it affects mammals, including humans, and quite frequently dogs, which is the pop culture kind of what is known about rabies. And once symptoms of rabies appear in any animal, it is almost always fatal. As of 2016, only 14 people have survived after symptoms of rabies has occurred, like have come up. Which is crazy, because it does infect a lot of people still, which I was surprised to learn. In fact, it causes about 56,000 deaths worldwide per year.
Oh my god.
And about 40% of which are in children under the age of 15.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah. It's mostly in developing countries because you can get vaccinated for rabies. Even once you've been bitten or it's been passed on to you in some other way, you can still be vaccinated as long as it's before symptoms or an appropriate time before symptoms appear. And the time it takes for rabies to be fatal just depends on how far the virus has to travel to the brain, basically. But on the upside, it is largely preventable. So it's just more, it's mostly about getting, I guess, information and vaccinations to countries that need it. It is probably, one of those things that will eventually slowly be eradicated. Now onto the behavioural controlling side of rabies.
Woo!
There are, so I found out there are two forms of rabies, and I don't know if these are the scientific names. It doesn't sound right to me, but I could not find the anything else. And it's, there's dumb rabies and there's furious rabies. Okay. So dumb rabies causes animals to become docile and lethargic. Makes sense. And furious rabies, which is the one everyone knows about, is the is what causes them to become aggressive. In animals like dogs, the furious form of rabies will cause them to bite other animals, which is obviously...
I will say, really quickly, Ella, it is a little hypocritical to say that all these Latin names are way too complicated and then also say that dumb and furious are too simple of names.
There is
there a good middle ground, maybe? There's definitely
a middle ground. Dumb is not necessarily what I would call scientific. I'll look into it a bit more.
I think it's just important to say, like, there are two ways it can impact you, and that is furious or excited.
Yes, I mean, that's the more important thing. Yeah. And that it's the furious stage or form that is the one that is the is more infectious due to the nature of biting.
Right.
We still don't know exactly how rabies why it causes people to
really
and dogs and other mammals to become aggressive, which is really interesting because it's such a common disease. There was research published in 2017. That found that the rabies virus actually has a region that's also found in snake toxins.
Oh.
So this part of the virus binds to acetylcholine receptors in muscle and inhibits the receptors, which allows it to affect muscle control. It also builds up between the synapses, in the synapses between neurons in the brain, and binds to the same receptors. And this is thought to alter communication between neurons, but the precise mechanisms of how is kind of unknown. I mean, it's probably due to the areas of the brain that inhibit certain behaviors, increase certain behaviors.
That's so interesting.
Wild, though.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Something I found even more interesting is that rabies. So, because rabies causes the host to salivate, this is not behavior. This is just more of a, this is like physiology, but I still find this really interesting. It causes the host to salivate more because there's virus in the saliva, which will increase the spread. But what it does is it causes painful spasms in the chest so that the host doesn't want to drink it because it hurts to drink. So the host will develop hydrophobia, like they will not want to drink at all. And it will stop them from drinking water and washing the virus back down.
Oh my god.
Yeah, super weird.
And again, I feel like we have to parse the... Because on the one hand, that feels like such a high order like concept of like or like a very like intelligent mm-hmm. behavior, but on the other hand, it I'm sure there are sort of basic mechanisms for hunger and thirst, because they are sort of, you know, like very basic concepts of animals to mm-hmm. to want. But it is so it is so creepy.
It is creepy, and I want to point out that what makes it even, I think, for some reason even creepier, even though this is a virus, it's so, like, basically, rabies virus makes 5 proteins. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
It has, which means it has, like, no genes, comparatively.
Wow! It's,
RNA genome of rabies apparently is 12 kilobytes in size.
Wow!
Compared to the human genome, which is between 5 times 10 to the 4 and 26 times 10 to the 4 kilobytes of DNA. The RNA genome of the rabies virus is 12 kilobytes. It's so simple, and it causes like such like amazingly huge changes in behavior.
Wow.
That's just blown my mind completely.
It's just like throwing like a very specifically shaped wrench into like mm-hmm. the engine of like
exactly
a car or something that just happens to precisely completely like dismantle a car, right? Like you throw this specific wrench in the car and then just like the wheels fall off.
Yeah.
That's wild. Oh man. And you know, I mean, I assume just like evolutionarily speaking, it's part of this is because of the fact that viruses have such short lifespans and can populate so quickly that you basically have these rapid forms of evolutions where they can form these such specific things that can specifically cause harm to mammals. Wow.
Oh my god. Whoa. I agree. Wow. So yeah, that's rabies. I'm just going to talk about one more mind controlling parasite, and that is, as Caroline's already mentioned, Toxoplasma gondii, the parasite, the myth, the legend.
Caroline got very happy at the mention.
I love this parasite so much. It was like one of the first ones I learned about in my degree. I'm ready for this. Yeah,
I also learned about it during my degree, which is
so bizarre.
It's so interesting that. Yeah, I learned about it and I really took to it, you know? Yeah. It's like, this is a great parasite. Love this.
I learned Zip Zap Zop, which is a great theater exercise. That's some of the stuff that I learned. But anyway, continue on. Never mind.
Why are you even here, Tom? Are you even science?
I'm here to talk about Naruto AMVs, so listen.
This is the episode I'm gonna like send to people where it's like Caroline and I talking about science and you talking about Naruto.
Yeah.
Who is this guy? Oh, he edits it so we let him be on here, you know?
Yeah, we let
okay. Toxoplasma gondii, which is the only one I can say confidently. Apart from rabies, because I love it so much. It's a protozoan parasite, which means it is a one-celled organism, and it can infect most warm-blooded animals, including humans. No, don't worry. It's thought to infect up to one-third. One-third of humans are thought to be currently hosting this parasite.
Oh.
So
one of us.
I mean, oh yeah, there's three of us. Statistically, oh, no. One of us has toxoplasma.
Whoever owns a cat probably has it. So Ella, congrats, you're probably the one.
Oh, it's me. Woo! Wow, I'm so amazing. Thank you. I want to take this opportunity to thank my cat for giving me this parasite.
Good Thanks, job, Charlie. Well done. You.
So we will get to why Charlie specifically, my cat, will have given me this. But first, I'll just say it causes the disease toxoplasmosis. But most people infected won't have symptoms. So it's not even like COVID in the fact that it's could be really dangerous for you to be having this. It's asymptomatically mm-hmm. and passing it over to people. because really, it very rarely causes symptoms. And when it does, it causes flu-like symptoms, but nothing like in the vein of COVID.
Right.
But what is interesting about toxoplasma gondii is that it can only replicate in the guts of cats.
Just cats.
I don't think they know why specifically. Not that I could find, but if Caroline, if you know
I do
more,
not know either, no.
I couldn't find anything specific.
That's so interesting.
The reason why I think people are really taken with this parasite, interested with it, I should say, is that research back in 2013 reported that it could remove rodents' innate fear of cats so that they would be more likely to approach cats, get killed by them, and pass on the parasite to cats. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that, again, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure there was some other research as well that said that it might even make them like
the
I'm about to go on to it.
Cut that!
Get rid of
you
it!
You can't no. Stop knowing things about this, Caroline.
So rude of me, I'm so sorry.
Well, you're right though, this is really recent research, because I learned about some undergrad, so did you. Maybe during your undergrad, the newer research was there, but it wasn't during mine. I finished my undergraduate degree in 2016.
Yeah.
And this new research didn't come out until last year. So basically it's not confirmed, but it might be that this isn't true, that it causes rodents to be specifically not fearful of cats. There is some truth in it though. So researchers at the University of Geneva found that mice infected with Toxoplasma gondii are less afraid of pretty much everything.
Mm.
They're less afraid of being around rats, which are potential predators. They're happy to investigate the urine of other predators like foxes and bobcats. They're generally happy to investigate other things. They just show less anxiety in general and have a greater tendency to explore. Now, mice are naturally neophobic, so they're avoidant and afraid of anything new and unfamiliar.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh. Same, buddy, same.
Oh. So it seems to me like Toxoplasma gondii is overriding this general neophobia rather than the very precise alteration to the perception of cats, which is what had been previously been thought up until very recently. I still think it's super devious and cool.
Yeah.
That behavior
can
be overridden like that.
Wow.
And again, we're not entirely sure why this happens yet. As you can see, this research is pretty new, but it's thought to achieve this by forming cysts in regions of the brain that process fear and decision making. And possibly by increasing levels of dopamine in the brain, which is involved in risk taking.
That's so interesting.
So
this is so
yeah.
What amazes me with these and sort of just like the discovery and research of these, especially because like a consistent theme has been like it's hard to figure out what's going on here. And I mean the fact that we're aware of it at all,
wild,
right? The fact that like there are these like interspecies connections that happen on the like cellular level, on the like virus sized level that change their behavior. I mean, we very easily could live in an alternate reality where just like occasionally weird stuff happens like this, right? Like occasionally, because these they could just be behavioral differences, but to the fact that we're able to track them down at all is probably, I guess, should not be taken for granted. It's amazing.
It is. You know that tweet you saw someone saying it's really nice. The podcast is good because the hosts are genuinely really excited about the new things they learn. When it's like talking about this kind of stuff, I'm like, oh yeah, no, I am actually
genuinely
super
so
excited.
Interested in this. Yeah.
I'm like, wow.
Ella, also you've set the bar so high, because usually it's one of us. It's two of us are learning something for the first time, but now that you've had this format where you write something a long time ago, and now turns out all of us can learn a mess at the same time. That's the bar's too high for that. You can't replicate that.
I think that's what we have to do every time. Yeah. You have to start writing all of your stuff
like now,
3 to 4 months in advance.
I
will also say it's amazing that this has now been found in fungi, in bacteria, in viruses, in worms, right? That one is a kind of a worm. The fact that it is, it's a good behavior, like it's a successful behavior for these organisms to do on the level of like, you know, like sight or like,
oh, I see what you mean. So like the reason like parasites in general they all come back to developing this kind of mechanism to spread.
Yeah,
that's really interesting.
There's this convergent evolution, yeah. It's a good strategy, evolutionarily, which is terrifying. That's so many, like, across...
I mean, that's barely scratching the surface. There are other types of parasites that I haven't covered here, and they do other kinds of things. There's a whole big world.
If we circle back to just Cordyceps alone, there are, what, hundreds of species that do this?
There are 200!
Yeah! And it's wild! I'm like, and it's just evolved so many times now. I'm like, don't like it.
I think for me, what makes this whole big group of things interesting is the, from a humanistic perspective, is that the insight it can give us to understanding how our own minds work.
Yes!
Even though that a lot of this kind of research is in the early days, understanding how, like, Toxoplasma gondii works, for example, would give us a really good insight into, like, fear behavior and reward behavior, that kind of thing.
That is a great point.
And it also highlights to me just how little we understand about our own brains.
Yes. Yeah.
Because we can't even figure this stuff out in insects that have an incredibly simple nervous system. Yeah. To figure out in ourselves is a whole other thing.
It's such an exciting field. For like the future, can you imagine the next 10 years where this research is going to be? It's so exciting.
Honestly, especially since
a lot of these parasites were discovered, we have much stronger tools now to investigate them.
Definitely
there will be a lot more, so watch this space for more parasite facts.
You were all here before it was cool.
So, my question of the week is, are elephants left-handed or right-handed? It's a really cute one. I'll leave it with zero context to start off with and see what you guys think.
Okay. Okay, Tom. Let's do this.
I don't know the exact number, but it's majority right-handed.
It's 90% of people.
Oh, wow.
It's really high. Yeah.
This is maybe a weird question, but has the number increased, the number of left-handed people, the percentage increased in like the last couple of decades?
Oh, I don't know.
Because being left-handed used to be like punished.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I would assume so.
And also, like, implements are made for right-handed people, right? So it's easier to, like, force yourself to be right-handed than it is to be...
That was something I was going to bring up later, but I can talk about it briefly now, actually.
I want to guess... Cool. I do want to guess first for the elephants.
Go on,
sorry. I would guess it might be a similar distribution to humans. That would be my guess.
Interesting. But I also...
I'm so curious how this was measured. Is it like which one they use to kick a soccer ball? Is it this is so because this I mean you know reminds me of those experiments we do where like with like mirror experiments with mammals to try to glean something about how they think about themselves. This also very much feels like a riddle. Like how do you figure this out? So that's my guess. But I will say also I did not know that I would not have guessed that in the first place at all. But also I guess it. Makes sense? Yeah. Oh.
And elephants... Yes. I will say one of the only things I know about elephants' trunks, which is what I assume they write with. they're not like hands. It's not a hand. It's analogous to a tongue.
Yeah.
Oh!
It has a name. I can't remember what it is. But are our tongues left-handed or right-handed, you know? mine's definitely right-handed, I can tell. Get your mind, put your mind right down in that go.
Nice, I love it. Do you have a guess, or are we good to keep going?
Yeah, okay, my guess, I will put my guess in, which is they learn from the humans that they...
That
teach them to write. So the hand that the human teaches them to write with would be the hand that they write with. What the handedness... would be my guess.
Whoa.
So, I did a little trick on you. So sorry, folks. So, in elephants...
Elephants aren't real.
When we were...
yeah, that's it.
Conspiracy theory unlocked. So when I'm talking about hands, I do mean their front feet.
Right.
Yes. And typically, they don't have much of a preference when it comes to their forefeet. However,
no.
Trunk side preference and tusk preference are both things.
Tusk preference.
Whoa.
So does that change your answers at all?
Whoa.
No.
Whoa.
No, you stand by it.
Because I was talking about trunks.
Yeah, yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense.
That's surprising, I guess.
Although I guess you're not talking about writing. You didn't say writing, and my mind immediately went there. Like, it was like...
your brain went to writing. Yeah, yeah. That was really interesting.
Because hand, for me, that's like the first thing that comes to mind, handedness right, being writing. Right. But I guess actually, everyone has a preference in, like Tom said, kicking a ball. I have a preference of the foot that I skate with as my leading
picking
leg.
Picking up a mug.
Right, yeah,
scrolling
yeah,
through
yeah.
your phone. Anything like that. We have a preference, and it tends to be the dominant hand. Yeah, yeah.
When I challenge someone to a duel, which glove do I take off?
Exactly! You know, if you're driving, I guess.
And I have another question to pose for you, Caroline.
Oh, this is so...
In this whole thing, if elephants have a preference, do other animals also have a preference?
Yeah, right, so yeah.
And is it based on intelligence?
I am going to bring up another animal at the end of this, which I think you're both going to absolutely love. I found it whilst researching this section, but we will get there, basically.
It's so interesting to think, like, is it a marker of intelligence, or is it just, like, a natural thing that happens that one naturally is more used? I'm so curious. I've never thought about this in this context.
Yeah.
And I'm realizing,
because
like,
you always think of it as such a human thing, and then all of a sudden it's like, wait,
yeah, yeah.
Other animals can have this as well. So, a 2003 paper, aptly titled Right Trunkers and Left Trunkers, Side Preferences of Trunk Movements in Wild Asian Elephants, found that this sort of functional asymmetry, so having a side preference, was necessary to perform skillful feeding, is the term they use. Basically, helps them eat better. They studied 41 wild elephants and looked at things like object contact, retrieval, and reaching. And in each of those categories, individual side preferences were found. So something else I also thought was quite interesting, a 2015 paper found that if they did have a trunk preference, sometimes there would also be a forefoot preference as well. Especially if they were right trunked, they were more likely to be right footed as well. And this meant that they could do more complex tasks together. But just by synchronizing their foot, basically, with their trunk.
Right.
Which is
super
interesting. So it just meant that they could do more complex tasks, things like that.
And does it tell you, as does the paper say, or have you found, if there's what the proportion of left to right preference is?
So it actually varies between species, which is really interesting. So a 2020 study in Asian elephants found it was pretty evenly split between right trunkers and left trunkers. However, so I'm going to move over to tusk for a second, because in African elephants, they're much more likely to be right tusked than left tusked.
Interesting.
So they'll have a tusk preference rather than a strong trunk preference, basically. The way that they studied this, I think, is super interesting. So for those people who don't know, African elephants will use their tusks to do things like stripping bark, digging, moving dirt off grass to make it easier to eat for them, stuff like that.
Did not know this.
They weighed. They took the weight of the tusks and saw which one was more worn down, basically. And they found that in 94% of them, there was a difference in the weights of the tusks, with the left tusk being heavier, showing that the left tusk was used less.
Clever!
It's so clever. It was so interesting.
So, and it's also just, like, it's similar to the human split as
it's
well.
It's very similar to the humans.
Right, so.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
So in Asian elephants, it's a 50-50 split. But in African elephants, it's very, very close to the human proportion, which is so interesting. I want to talk a little bit about how this develops in elephants as well, because I think this is super interesting. So yeah. The 2015 study that I referenced earlier looked at 57 mother-offspring pairs and found that the offspring's trunk preferences was completely independent of the mother's trunk preferences.
That's very surprising to me.
Yeah. It suggests that these are not maternally inherited. It also found that it wasn't based on things like sex or age either.
It also suggests that it's not behavioural. Like, it's not inherited, but it's also not behavioural. So they're not, like, observing it and using that side, which means that it is genetic, surely.
Right.
There is a genetic component to it.
Yeah.
That's super interesting.
It's so good, and there's a little bit more to it that it's so good. So the 2020 study found that trunk preference developed as early as 3 months of age.
Wow.
Whereas usually in elephants, it takes about a year for them to be able to fully use their trunk.
So it's
super early on in their development. They pick a side, basically. So that also suggests that there is a genetic component to it, because they learn it so quickly before they've learnt anything else, really. So I thought that was super, super interesting.
I mean, it is.
I couldn't find much evidence about how this evolved. The 2020 study suggested phylogenetic inertia, which is the idea of, like, previous evolution impacting future evolution. But it didn't really go into any further detail. And the study itself suggested that more research is needed to confirm this theory anyway. So, you know, watch that space. Looking at evolution and how it might have impacted this.
Phylogenetic inertia might be my phrase of the week.
That's, it's the phrase of the podcast. I had to, like, fully wrap my head around what it meant just to say that one sentence.
I'm sorry, no, the phrase of the podcast is pepper shaker of death.
Okay, yeah, that does win.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's basically my bit, but I do want to talk very briefly. Oh, first off, the human thing. So there are a few theories about why humans have side preferences. Things like genetics are a big one. Language dominance is another one. The idea that the left side of our brain controls language, and therefore it's more likely left side of brain control right side of body. Left side of the brain do a lot of things. It's a theory. It's not necessarily confirmed.
But it
is very interesting.
Left side, right side stuff is, you know,
it's pretty shaky as it is.
Yeah.
And also the idea of, like, because society is mostly designed around right-handed people, you're more likely to find right-handed people.
I mean, that makes sense for humans. Yeah,
all of those things apply to humans, but not necessarily to elephants.
Yeah.
So we don't really know why.
And I guess all of this stuff will support the idea that humans are more, might also just be more naturally become right-handed.
Inclined. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to talk very briefly about the other animal that I mentioned earlier, which is actually the honeybee.
No! Bees...
No way! So bees aren't necessarily right-handed, left-handed in the same way that we are. But a 2017 study suggested that they might have a side preference. So they were looking at the foraging behaviours of bees, of honeybees specifically.
Oh, wow.
And they made little obstacle courses for honeybees. It's so sweet. They made like a box with holes. And they made one big central hole, and then either on the left side or the right side, they made much smaller and much more difficult holes. And they found that, so it's 50% of the time, the bee would just go through the main hole. However, the other 50% of the time, it was pretty evenly split about if they chose to go through the right hole or the left hole, to the point where the bee would even land and crawl through the hole just to get to its preferred side.
Wow.
We theorize that this is to help make accessing spaces easier. if 50% of the bees are going to a different entrance,
you're
going to get less clogged up.
That's so good. That's so good. Bees are so amazing.
Oh my god.
They're so perfectly constructed as beings.
They're so good. They're so pure and wonderful.
If only we were bees.
Sorry, just to clarify, they do have a preference, but it's split individually, is what you're saying.
Yeah, so 50% of the bees just didn't have a preference at all.
Okay.
Of the other 50%, it was roughly around...
Sure,
a quarter of bees would be left-handed and a quarter of bees would be right-handed.
That's a lot.
It's a lot of bees. Yeah. So yeah, I found that whilst you were doing this and it was too good not to share with you. But it does add to the question of, like, does intelligence have a factor in if you're left-handed and right-handed? It makes it so much more difficult. Things like apes also have preferences as well. There were a lot of other animals that have gone out of my head now, but it's really, really common in the animal kingdom.
I just want to say, first of all, for that experiment, it's such a beautiful experiment with how simple, it's literally bees and
it's
like cutting
so
holes in wood.
Yeah.
And also in my mind, it very much looks like a bee version of like the double slit experiment in physics where like the bee particles go through the holes. But that aside, like, it's so simple. And it's just like a question that you have to think to ask in the first place. And then the implications for it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, the guy who was doing this wasn't looking to see B-side preference. It was just something that he...
So it's not a question you have to think to ask. You just notice.
Accidentally found out, yeah. He accidentally found this out and then basically changed his study to that question.
I mean, to be fair, that is so much of research, is like just noticing something and being like, oh, this is more interesting than what I was asking.
That's the route we're going, yeah.
What nature shows me is more interesting than what I as a human can think of asking.
Wow, yeah. Can I ask, do y'all think it is a sign of intelligence?
No, I mean, it's... The bee thing makes me think it's just coding, right? You know, then... it's more efficient for them 50% to go one way and 50% to go the other, then
if you think about in humans, it probably is more efficient to have one hand be dominant than to have both hands doing a lot of work.
It almost feels like a physical inevitability that something would be used more often than perfectly balanced. Like, that feels like it would take more effort to be...
Because I think what's really interesting about the elephants, so in humans... We have paired organs. We have two hands. In bees, they go one way or the other. Whereas in elephants, it's one organ that they are still finding a preference with. And I think that's so interesting. And maybe that is a sign of intelligence. It's like, even with one thing.
It could also totally be a behavior that, arises by both simple and complex means, right?
Yeah.
Like, there could be,
If we look at humans in the simplistic way, which would be right-handedness arises commonly due to unconscious reasons, then you might think it would be something like, you know, if you're falling, then you need to reflexively like grab onto something, your right hand will shoot out, right?
Yeah.
It's the stronger, more confident hand, like you've developed it to be that way. Stuff like that. Or like using tools is probably not the right way, because I don't know. It's really interesting.
It's so interesting.
Now I'm questioning, like, bilateral symmetry also. Like, I'm not taking that for granted anymore. I'm like, why do we have two hands? It's like, that's so...
I've just pulled out an article, which I'll add in the references list. But apparently in chimpanzee populations, around 65 to 70% of them are right-handed. In gorillas, 75% are right-handed. But 66% of orangutans are left-handed.
Oh.
Which is really interesting. So, yeah.
Well, that's such an odd one. Such an odd one. And that's something you just never, ever think about. Except for in the context of,
not
left-handed
at all.
People have to buy special scissors.
Hold on. Who we got on the podcast? I'm a righty.
Yeah, I'm a right-handed. Sorry,
left-handed people.
No Satanists here.
Now for an ad break. This podcast sponsored by Left-Handed Scissors.
We did do a Victorian school day where we had to like pretend we were Victorian children, and all the left-handed kids in class were like forced to write with their right hands for that day, which is really dark. Otherwise, they get smacked.
We don't have to include this in the podcast, but I think it's really interesting, is that my twin brother, we think, should have been left-handed, but he was somewhat ambidextrous when he was younger. So he used to write along one side of the page, and when he'd get to the middle, he'd swap hands and write with the other hand.
That's so interesting.
So we obviously were like, my parents were like, you're going to be right-handed. And now his handwriting is terrible, and they're like, we made a mistake, we should have let him be left-handed instead.
It is very interesting, but that might just be because his handwriting's bad, to be fair.
It could be. I prefer the theory that he should have been left-handed.
So, today's miscellaneous topic is Naruto Bohemian Rhapsody AMVs. And I know what you're thinking. Don't I mean Sasuke, friend and rival to Naruto, whose character arc more directly mirrors the story in Bohemian Rhapsody? And yes, of course, I just wanted to be approachable at the beginning.
Oh my god, you literally
so approachable
said
right now.
All of those words separately mean something to me, and together mean absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
So,
except also, but wait, before we dive into this, I want to get this out of the way now.
Yes.
The way we pronounce that anime / manga is completely different, and it really throws me off.
Is it, do you say Naruto?
Naruto.
Yeah, yeah.
Naruto.
Say it again, Tom. Naruto.
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 Naruto. Naruto takes an elevator to go to his apartment. And then you would say Naruto takes the lift to go to his flat. And that's just something we're gonna have
Oh, well done, Tom. You're learning the lingo.
You're getting it. Well done.
I have to. I'm the minority here. I'm
you
the American.
You are outnumbered. I'm so sorry.
Though we're joping around, I want to be crystal clear. I want to say, so this topic is not a joke. In April,
I'm sorry, no. You can't be like, this topic is not a joke after you said Naruto Bohemian Rhapsody AMV.
In April, I don't know if I've told you all this. I got asked to write a piece for the science fiction website Tor.com, which is a part of Macmillan Publishing, and so of course I wrote 1,500 words on one of my favorite pieces of art, and as of the release of this, it should be out, and you can find it. You can read it there. I use better words there, and it is technically the first time I've been paid to write something, which is wild. And it is about, It is about Naruto Bohemian Rhapsody AMVs. So,
I can't believe you've been paid to write about this. Sorry, we can't move past that.
How did they approach you? Why did they approach
you?
What are you?
Wow. Wow, okay. They were like, you're gonna have a great podcast soon. I can feel it.
Did they find you through TikTok?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
So, what are y'all's familiarity with the band Queen, the anime Naruto, and the art form of AMVs?
Okay, I have never seen Naruto, but I'm aware of it conceptually. Queen is one of the biggest British bands in history, so obviously, and Bohemian Rhapsody is one of the best songs ever made.
Yeah.
And I know about AMVs. I've never watched one. Like, this is the cover thing, right? Where people put their own dub over anime.
So an AMV stands for an anime music video. Really big on YouTube.
Okay, no, I don't know. I didn't know that.
Oh, God. Okay, that's hilarious.
Yeah, okay. We're going to go into this. So for context, for everyone who doesn't know, Queen is a historic British rock band. Naruto is a historic Japanese manga and anime about ninjas. And AMV stands for anime music video, and it's when fans edit together clips from an anime to match a song that they like. And I will say, I think in today's world, a crossover like this, especially when corporations will do this, can feel kind of pandering or nonsensical or cringe or all three if you're unlucky. But while some of them these days especially feel like sort of soulless cash grabs, what makes the art form of the AMV so rad to me is it fundamentally spits in the face of corporations when you think about it, right? It's like, oh, you have a song owned by a mega record corporation and footage from one of the most successful anime of all time. I'm going to grab the shittiest pirated versions of both that I can find in 2005, and I'm going to smash them together in my artistic vision and upload it for free on YouTube in glorious 300 by 240 resolution. Copyright, haven't heard of her.
I'll be honest, Tom, you've made that a lot deeper than it is.
Single-handedly.
Yes, I think one of the most quaint markers of this era that y'all might remember are these magic words that people used to add onto videos, like protective incantations. These like all caps disclaimers being like, no copyright, no copyright.
People still do that in the description of YouTube videos. Disclaimer.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
It's like, I don't think that's going to stop them, to be honest.
I feel like these days, you know, we were a lot more educated on the fact that, you know, the copyright whims of YouTube are cruel and fickle. But back then, we really did. I mean, there literally weren't. There was no precedent on these things. This was the first time that these cases were on this scale. And so we really did think we could just say swipe or no swiping and be legally protected under the law.
We had so much hope back then. Oh, my God.
I was going to say, I want to represent another side of fandom, because anime music videos are pretty much analogous to teen girl fan vids for, like, teen TV shows with cheap, like, romantic pop music over and, like, weird cuts, and, like, you put the lyrics on the screen and it's like all the I love, and it's very similar, except for I imagine boys make these and they make them look cool, and girls made the other ones and they made them look romantic. It was like the ships and stuff. I mean, it still happens, and I'm sure AMVs still happen.
Yeah, but it's the same heart in that, which is amazing.
Exactly, it really is.
So I pulled up some of these just because I love them so much. One of these, like, legal incantation reads, this is by user Sahara1128, and it reads, all caps, I do not claim rights to either music or video. Each belongs to their respective owners. No copyright infringement intended. But my favorite one of these, like, spells, legal spells, perfectly encapsulates why I love this art form. This is by Killer Rainbows with a Z, and it's, again, it's all caps, and it goes, disclaimer, I don't own Naruto or Queen. I don't own anything. That's
amazing.
No one thought you did, Rainbow. It's okay. It's okay.
And all this makes you think of is fan fiction, because people always put these at the start. Even now, they put these at the start of fan fiction. I don't own this, but it's just wild to me. Like, why do you do this? What, I kind of get it then, I guess, because it's children not understanding copyright.
Yeah, right.
I don't get why people still do it now.
I will also say, back then, I don't think even adults understood copyright.
Well,
on the
internet, it's
right?
Children and adults understand copyright. Now everyone knows. If you watch YouTube, you know that this video is going to get copyright claimed.
Yeah.
Right? So.
I will say, I just love, I don't own Naruto or Queen. I don't own anything. And that's
honestly,
really the heart of.
What a mood. Same.
Yeah, honestly. So, if y'all don't know, I'm a huge Queen fan. I used to have a collage of Freddie Mercury that I made in my childhood bedroom. This is the picture of it I took recently. There's a pencil for
amazing.
Scale. I'll upload it to the Discord.
Oh my God.
I printed that out on multiple sheets of paper.
You're so cute.
And Bohemian Rhapsody is fully, unironically, one of my favorite songs. I think it's beautiful and powerful and funny and delightful all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I love Naruto also, unironically. In a seminar in school once, I quoted a line from Naruto, and I cited it as a Japanese story, so that no one would question it.
That's incredible. Oh my God.
And listen, the show is dumb, and it has problems, but I do love it. And so one reason I love this AMV is obviously subjectively totally biased here, but, you know, running across it on the early internet as a kid and seeing someone else who loves Naruto and specifically Bohemian Rhapsody enough to take the time to do this thing is it's so exciting.
That's so interesting to me. That, because, I mean, did the people around you, like, I'm saying this because Queen are very, very popular in the UK, and Bohemian Rhapsody is like, you can ask any single person in this country and they will know almost all the lyrics to that song.
Yeah.
Like, that's just... So if I saw a video with Bohemian Rhapsody on, I wouldn't assume that that was someone who was a fan of Bohemian Rhapsody. Just, you know.
Well, to be fair, like, to go through all of the effort...
That's, yeah, okay.
That's
Bohemian
the thing,
Rhapsody,
you know?
Has so many lyrics.
It's long.
Yeah.
And it
Wait,
has...
they do they do the whole song?
Oh, yes!
That's so much effort.
And so there was one Sasuke Bohemian Rhapsody AMV that I watched religiously. And in that era, you know, when I, like, just got an iPod, this was the main way I listened to that song, was to watch that video over and over and again. But also, I will say, you know, analytically, objectively, I think they're a great match against all odds because... So, for context, most AMVs are, like, fight scenes paired to an Imagine Dragons song. That's not an exaggeration. That's a lot of them.
Waking up to ash and blood.
Oh, the cringe that I'm feeling
breathing
just from this.
It's... The chemicals.
Listen, no. And listen. They get you hype. But the other kind are, there's a lot of, like, romantic scenes paired to Ed Sheeran songs.
No!
Again, not an exaggeration.
This is very noughties fan vid energy as well.
So yeah.
This is peak internet right here.
And you also, you know for a fact, I listen to a lot of Broadway musical AMVs. That's just something we're all going to have to accept about my past. But Bohemian Rhapsody has... both of these things. It has all of these things. And it also has the Broadway things in it, right? It starts with the most sullen, resigned ballad in the whole world. And then it goes into this goofy theatrical scene with, like, multiple characters. And then it's a headbanging guitar riff. And Naruto also has all of these things, right? It's about a teenager who houses a demon inside of him that has killed countless people and he has no family. But at the same time, he's a shithead who loves ramen and slacking off. And it also has animation that makes you feel like every cell on your body is on fire and it's amazing. And so in my mind, it works. It doesn't just encapsulate a moment or like a single fight scene or a single romance scene. It really captures the whole show and the whole song at the same
time. I want to say, I think this is incredibly sweet, by the way, because you are very clearly like, love these things, and
yes,
it's really nice
fully.
To see. I'm going to make a very gentle counter argument, which is, I think that this Bohemian Rhapsody specifically would fit a lot of animes very beautifully.
Yeah,
because
true.
Anime as a concept can put like these really really like deep emotional lows with these kind of like ridiculous funny highs. Like, is one of the only like mediums that can do that and still be like, you know, watchable.
Totally. Yeah. I think that's a great point. I will say specifically that there are some parallels between Itachi and Sasuke's storyline that very much mirrors the storyline of Freddie Mercury and, you know, the remorse that he feels for killing. But anyway, we can go on. But no, I think you're totally right. The last thing I want to say is that in my mind's eye, there is one video, specifically Sasuke Bohemian Rhapsody. If I haven't been clear, Sasuke is a character in Naruto. There's one specific Sasuke Bohemian Rhapsody AMV that I think of, that I remember watching, that like perfectly tells the story of these characters and also of the song. And it doesn't exist anymore. I have not been able to find
no.
it. And that's just a fact of a lot of internet art, you know, that I think we're learning to realize. And I will say, I think the trade-off, you know, I feel like earlier on, you know, with literature, these works of art got made that were so preserved, but that was also because there were so few of them, you know. And I think nowadays with a lot of digital art, you know obviously they aren't as permanent, but the trade-off is that you can make them, and you can make them so easily.
That's so true.
But that the fact that it's impermanent doesn't mean it's any less important or impactful.
Oh, Tom, you're bringing up bad memories for me, man. there was a fan vid that I watched back in, like, I want to say like 2009 or 11 maybe, which was so dumb. It was of Torchwood, which is a spin-off of Doctor Who fan vid. Yes. With the song Heavy in Your Arms by Florence and the Machine over it. And oh. I literally looked for it probably earlier this year, and it's not there anymore because it's been gone for years.
It's tremendously filled with copyright. There's so many.
Yeah, it's not filled with copyright. It's so outdated, right? There's and yes, I guess I didn't think about it in the context of there's no need to preserve these things unless you personally want to preserve them, which maybe I should start doing that. But I don't connect to anything the same way I did when I was that age, so.
Yeah. And also these people probably never know how much it affected you, right? It's just someone,
that's
it could have been someone
true.
Anywhere.
So yeah. True. Like, if it has, like, a few thousand views, they might not realize that you're one of those people who was there, like, watching it all the time, or, like, you know, really getting into it. So if you're out there and you made fan vids or fan fiction or AMVs or anything like that growing up, and I know many of you did, I know I did,
I feel like the Venn diagram with our audience.
And honestly, if you're somebody who does it now...
If you're someone who does it now,
because like TikTok is such a huge place for stuff like this now. And there's so much of it out there, which is wonderful, but it's exactly the same process happening over again, basically.
It is. You're absolutely right. And I just want to say that someone out there, even if you only have a few hundred views or a few hundred reads or likes or whatever,
that's a lot. Yeah,
someone is like in love with that piece of work.
Yeah,
I guarantee it.
Uh-huh, it's so true. Wow. It's so true. Do not put yourself down just because you think, oh, only 100 people saw this. No, that had an impact on people, we promise.
The thesis statement to this, the last thing I want to say, the fact that a kid somewhere can like messily and excitedly tie a queen-shaped arrowhead onto a Naruto-shaped stick and fashion this arrow and shoot it haphazardly in the face of copyright and in the face of criticism into the internet, and that never knowing where this arrow will land, and that the fact that it can land, it can hit me as a kid square in my heart, I think that's beautiful. And now you all have to take back all the laughter you had at the beginning when I said what this
love,
topic was.
No, okay, first of all, not taking it back. Still ridiculous.
No, yeah.
Look, if someone wants to laugh at me for my Florence and the Machine Torchwood fan vid love, that's totally fine. And I can still acknowledge that I think it's a very sweet and meaningful thing.
Both of these things can be true. That's true.
While simultaneously acknowledging it's ridiculous.
It's pretty cringy. Yeah. Yeah, we're all really feeling it right now. But we do also love it at the same time.
I know. As someone who was very, deeply interested in those kind of things and still sometimes looks for, like, fan videos, because I like the way people construct those, like, how they view the story.
It's
interesting seeing how other people's brains work in that way.
You know, I definitely feel what you're feeling right now, Tom. I really like you brought up a lot of good feelings in me and made me think about actually the fleetingness of these things as well.
Memento mori.
I'm just gonna have an existential crisis over here. Don't know about anybody else.
I know a great song that could score that. And it's a little track called Bohemian Rhapsody.
This is really interesting, Tom. I was worried because I thought that you were going to explain the video to us.
And so in this first scene, it's from season two, episode one, in the scene where Kakashi and Sasuke.
I thought you were gonna like really break down.
scene by scene, frame by frame.
What was a frame by frame analysis of my favorite? To be fair, I think I even would have enjoyed that somehow, which is weird.
I'm glad.
Thanks, Tom. I actually really like that.
That was great.
Does anyone want to plug any pluggables?
I will do a really quick shout out. Last episode we asked folks for reviews on the podcast, and we got a handful, and then they're all very sweet.
Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you.
So you can review on Apple Podcasts, but this is a review from Tacey, who says, "I love all three of these wonderful humans, and this podcast is a delight." So,
thank you so much. It's so sweet. We really, really appreciate it.
And we read all of them.
We do. And not just does a lot for the podcast, it also does a lot for us, personally.
That's true.
And it really does.
Diminishing self-esteem.
I will also just plug myself. I'm Tom Lum person everywhere. And I will also plug the version of the article that you can read. I use more flowery, less conversational language, and I talk more about some of the stuff. At tor.com.
You break it down scene by scene.
I break it down second by second. In this scene, you can see, no, but I'm proud of it, and I'm very happy I got the chance to do that, so, yeah.
Well done. Oh, that's very impressive.
Maybe put a link in the, we'll see. But yes.
There'll be a link in the show notes. I have decreed it on my episode. Caroline, plug yourself.
I will plug me. I'm caroline.roper.art everywhere apart from Twitter, where I am Caroline the Bug. I will also shout out our website, where you can find all the places to listen to the podcast, all of our socials, and our Discord server as well. It's letsleareverythingpod.com.
In the Discord server, I will post the Freddie Mercury collage, so you can see it
there. If you want to see that. Oh my god. And if you want to suggest topics for us to talk about or generally chat about the podcast, that's a great place to go as well.
Yeah.
I will plug me. I am big_science_energy on TikTok. I am Ella Hubber on Twitter, because why not? And because they're not real. if you want to see, that's my professional Twitter. So if you want to see,
you must explain your Twitter handle right now.
So if you want to see that, great. And I will also plug, on the 17th of November, I am doing a stand-up comedy show, a science stand-up comedy show in London. Woo! So if you live in or around London, the tickets are now available for that at the link in my bio on TikTok. And all proceeds go to charity.
Aww, wonderful. We'll throw a link in the podcast notes. Amazing.
Oh, okay. That would be nice. Thanks. Link in the notes.
And don't forget to stop by letsleareverythingpod.com/socks between November 5th and 14th to support the podcast, support partners in health, and get yourself some nice socks.
And thank you too for an amazing episode. Today we have
thank you so much.
Today we have learned about behavior controlling parasites. Very creepy. We have learned about the handedness of elephants and bees. Very cute. And we have learned about Naruto Bohemian Rhapsody AMV. Very lame. No. also very sweet.
Thank you.
Please join us next time, where we will learn about everything. Let's Learn Everything is independently produced and hosted by Ella Hubber, Tom Lum, and Caroline Roper. Editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum.
These are fun. I like doing these.
I know. It's actually really fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really nice to, like, research something, then talk to someone about it. It's nice to hear about new things.
Yeah.
I know that's such a simple, stupid thing, but it's so nice.
I'm always like, oh wow, I'm learning things. Who would have thought?